This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 363, recorded on time this week on Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me this week, for the first time in a long time, Miss Megan Townsend is here. You can find her at Oh Megan Townsend on all the social media that matters, and /OhMeganTownsend on Twitch. Hello.
Hi, it's been such a long time.
It's been a long time. We had some scheduling hiccups in, I want to say, the end of April. And because you're only on the show about once a month, that just meant like a 2 month gap that you weren't around. So, but I want to again, I'll thank Lou for filling in and Alistair, of course, for filling in over the last few weeks when you weren't around to be on the show. But I'm happy to have you back. What the heck is new?
I'm happy to be back. Honestly, I had like a minute where I was just like, it's been a long time since I've been on the show. This feels really weird. Not a lot's been new, just been working on stuff.
A lot of creativity, a lot of Dungeons and Dragons.
A lot of creativity. Yeah, well, we were talking before about stuff and, in the pre-show. And I'm starting a podcast, which I feel like some people already know about. I know that Cosmic Dancer for sure is kind of going to know about it. It's not fully done yet, but we're thinking of making it like a video podcast. Like, going to stream it live on Twitch and then take the video and put it up on YouTube later and then also just, export the audio afterwards just for audio audiences, audio listeners. So we're working out some stuff. I did some photography and I made, like, some graphics. As of right now, it's a temporary, maybe permanent, but right now, like, the placeholder is Dungeon My Dragon podcast on Twitch. And then we'll work out some more things. We haven't done any shows yet. I'm sure there'll be show announcements at some point later, but that's kind of what I've been working on right now, aside from like my own personal stuff and, scripts and just things.
So can we give a little bit of a tease as to what Dungeons My Dragons is about?
Oh yeah. So, it's about D&D. I don't know if that was evident by the name.
Well, it is, but you mentioned something in the pre-show that I think was really interesting in terms of what's out there now and versus what you want to do.
Yeah. So, when the topic was suggested of like doing a D&D podcast, I find that most people go the route of basically recording themselves doing like playing Dungeons and Dragons, which is awesome. I've listened to a lot of them. I love a lot of them, but I feel like that is a little bit oversaturated in the D&D market. And sometimes if it's just me, I just like to hear about the fun times that happen in a session, like the funny moments that kind of come out of it. And this kind of spawned during one of my Twitch streams with a couple of friends, and then everyone was just chatting D&D, and it was just like, maybe we should just like have a show that focuses on talking about D&D, like just like, discussing it. And it's also something that I don't see a lot in a lot of like female spaces. Any D&D content that I consume personally, that's just, about strategy or character development or, funny moments with playing. Oftentimes that is, it's usually very male dominated, which is great. But me and my friends play a lot of D&D and we're mostly a group of girls with only a few guys. And, I would love to kind of like share some of our stories because we have some great stories. Like there are still moments that we talk about from campaigns from like 2 years ago that still makes us really happy. And it's like jokes that kind of keep coming back into our existing campaigns. Nice.
In jokes are always really fun. That's what always makes me feel like a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Because you get that one episode of the podcast where somebody's dropping that inside joke. You get the story. You get the inside joke explained to you, and then you're part of the inside joke. So that 10 episodes later, when someone drops the one-liner without an explanation, you find it very funny because you're then part of the crew.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very, very cool. That's, exactly. That sounds great. Like, I would love to hear that.
Yeah.
It. having not played a lot of D&D and having tried to get into some of the live play sessions, I do find them a little long in the tooth. And I would imagine that sometimes
yes.
people would appreciate the, I want to get a D&D podcast fix, but I don't want to spend 2.5 hours, you know, listening
yeah.
to a game where really only the cool stuff that happens is maybe 45 minutes, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So we kind of want to focus more on, like, you know, the funny moments, and then, you know, also open it up. Cause I mean, this kind of came from Cosmic Dancer. She was like, I would love to play, but I don't really know how to play, and
right.
I don't really know how to get started. So it's more so like, you know, early entry resources. Cause you don't need to buy anything to play D&D. That's a common misconception. A lot of people are like, oh, I need books. I need dice. I need all this stuff. I'm like, you can do everything online for 100% free. Including dice and tooling, dice rolls and everything, rules, all of that is very, very, very widely available online for next to nothing. And there are some paid services that will kind of like enhance the experience later. And, you know, that's something that, you know, we might talk about at some point, but really all you need is imagination and some friends to hang out with. And that's pretty much it. And even if you don't have any friends in person to hang out with, there are people online who may also be in the same boat who would love to play a game with someone and make new friends. So it's, you know.
Yeah, I know, for example, in my Discord, in my Joel Duggan Discord
yeah.
Channel, there's been talk of trying to get some people together to play Dungeons and Dragons that have not played before or are unsure of their time commitment. So people are looking to join a group, but they don't want to join a super serious group. I remember having the same sort of situation when I was trying to join raid groups or dungeon
mm-hmm.
Weekly dungeon
crawls
and stuff like that in World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And that I had to try to find people. Like, I usually would seek out parents, people that had full-time jobs, you know, because I was busy. I was like, I can't raid twice a week. Like, I don't have 6 to 9 hours.
It's too much.
And all the
it's
prep
a lot.
That you
it's
have
a lot
to
of
do.
Time to sink into
yeah.
it. Yeah.
And so I wanted something more casual. And so one of the things I liked about when I was playing D&D was the fact that it was only once a week for a couple hours, because everybody had to work Monday morning, and it always seemed to mm-hmm. work out pretty well. Well, that's really cool. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it as it develops. And when it eventually launches, let me know, because I know
yes.
a target audience that I think might be very interested in listening to it, especially because they've gotten to know you on this show for quite a while.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Discord, if you're wondering how the heck do I get in there, you can do that by supporting the Citadel Cafe or by supporting me on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/Joel Duggan or patreon.com/the Citadel Cafe, that's how we make the stuff. The Citadel Cafe is listener supported, and this is the first week of the month, and it has been a little while since I've taken the time to thank all of our patrons for keeping the show ad-free. I really appreciate it. I'm glad I don't have to read ads. I'm glad, in order to make the show financially viable for me to produce it, that I don't have to seek out other means. It all comes directly from listeners, and I can't thank you enough. Over the last few months, I know that, you know, there's been a lot of job changes for people. There's been a lot of shifting and stuff in the economy, and yet nothing has changed for the Citadel Cafe. Everybody is still here. And I just really wanted to say thanks. It means an awful lot to me as a creator, as a podcaster of, I guess, 8 or 9 years now, that I get to do this. I get to share some cool content with you, but then also, you know, get the financial support to keep the show running, which is just fantastic. And sometimes people don't realize this, because I have this conversation every now and again on my Twitch stream, but very seldom do I have it on the podcast. And that is, both the Citadel Cafe and my personal Patreon both point towards the same Discord. If the Citadel Cafe is not necessarily something that you're going to support or feel like supporting or can financially afford to support, maybe look at the Joel Duggan Patreon, because it's structured differently, because the content is different, and they both lead to the same place. All roads lead to Rome. It's all one community, and everybody in there is just having a really good time. It's a really cool place. I've seen everything from recipes for pumpkin chocolate chip cookies that I want to try in the Food Driven Human channel.
Oh no, that's so good.
Right? And then
they sound so good.
And in addition to that, we had people kind of live blogging and posting and sharing links to space and space news this past weekend, as well as tips for tabletop gaming and how to do so virtually when there's a global pandemic and you can't all sit around the table. Having some of that technology available and some of those resources that you're talking about, you know, with your new show, having those being shared around for people that don't know what they might need or what they might want to look into when they want to participate. It's all just happening, you know, in the Discord. And I really enjoy just the level of discourse. Like, it's not social media. It's a conversation, and people are posting fun, meaningful, interesting things and having conversations about them. It's been great. It's been super, super cool to see. And so again, I can't thank both my patrons, the one for me personally, but also the patrons of the Citadel Cafe. So again, just look for us by name, patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. Right now, the bottom level entry gets you access to everything that we offer in terms of like bonus episodes and Discord access and all that kind of stuff. So just check it out. And if you have any questions, I am 100% transparent about all of this. So if you need to know where the money is going or what it's being used for, I won't get into a long rant here. But if you want to know, just write me an email and I'll be happy to kind of line it up and let you know how that all gets, spent in terms of the hosting and all that kind of stuff. But speaking of space news, this weekend, I took the time on Saturday to watch the NASA SpaceX launch of the Falcon 9 rocket. Did you check this out at all?
I didn't. My brain was otherwise occupied on other things that were going on.
Right.
But tell me about it, because I love space, and I kind of am sad that I missed it,
so
because I feel like it would have been really cool to listen to.
It was because of the Discord. I knew it was happening, and then the weather shifted and they had to postpone. It was supposed to happen mid last week and they had to postpone to Saturday. And so I knew it was going to happen Saturday, and I was reminded by the Discord, by people talking about it and anticipating, and like, hey, are you going to tune in? Yes, I'll tune in later today, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. So then around the time of the launch, I tuned into the NASA live feed on YouTube, which I've watched other launches before, but these were just various launches of different situations, not necessarily things that involved human beings. And so on Saturday, we'll have a link to all this in the show notes, the Falcon 9 rocket, which was it's a SpaceX, so it's a private company, successfully took astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley from Cape Canaveral in Florida to the International Space Station in orbit. They docked on Sunday, about 19 hours later. Everything went off without even a blip of an error. Like, everything was just smooth as glass from my perspective, not knowing a heck of a lot about space travel. But of all the things that can go wrong, if anything, one little thing is off, they scrub the whole thing. And to watch this with the countdown, really articulate people talking about what they're doing and why they're doing it and what the next phases are, watching this thing get up to something crazy like 16,000 kilometers an hour. 16,000 kilometers an hour. It hit 600 kilometers an hour in the first 30 seconds. It was incredible to watch. I found the feed from the live stream on Saturday, and I've queued it up to like T-minus 30 seconds. I'll have that in the show notes. I'll also have a link to the NASA and the SpaceX YouTube channels. Both of them have a combination of like either longer videos from the pre-launch or like highlight reels, so you can get some of the cool visuals without having to sit through like a 20-minute video. But I'm going to defer to someone that's a lot better versed in this kind of stuff. And I was pleasant to find this in an unexpected location. I mentioned last week that I watch a lot of Hermitcraft, which is a Minecraft video content, I guess, group. And CubFan135 is one of my favorite hermits. He does some really cool stuff. And in Hermitcraft Season 7, Gold Rush, Episode 30, about a minute and 20 into the show, CubFan interrupts some boring tasks that he's doing on Minecraft to basically let everyone know about the SpaceX launch that happened on the weekend. And he's really into space.
Cool.
He's a space nerd and he knows a lot of stuff about this. And so it was really cool to have someone that has the background knowledge explain everything in kind of layman terms, what it means. NASA was talking about stuff, but it was more about all the technical stuff about what was going on during the launch and in the rocket, and less about the significance, because the significance is kind of like SpaceX tooting their own horn, which they weren't really doing, which is fine. It's kind of good that they weren't. So the reason why this is significant is that there hasn't been an astronaut from America launched into space in 9 years. This is the first.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is the first private company to fund a commercial space launch. Now, it's a test flight. They're not going to be up there for very long. They're just kind of up and back. But the hope is that this is going to greatly reduce the cost of sending scientists, engineers, etc. into space, allowing more research and experience to be conducted in space, where some things, and this is a little tidbit that CubFan dropped to me that I didn't realize, things like growing synthetic organs is much easier to do in near zero gravity. And I never,
I never really took
the time to think about like the kind of science that happens up there. I just, I automatically kind of go to astronomy, you know, and like astrophysics and like that kind of stuff. I don't think about the medical or the energy or the other kind of researches that, that happen in next to zero G on the International Space Station, and how it benefits the whole planet, you know, when all is said and done. But anyway, it was just stupid cool to watch this rocket take off and achieve what it was set to do. And I understand that there is an absolute immense amount of brains and hard, hard work and real risk that goes into all of this kind of stuff. And they made it look easy. And like it is impressive. Like it is very impressive.
That's really cool.
Yeah. No, it was a lot of fun to watch. So we'll have links to all this kind of stuff, including Cub's little video in the show notes. And I would encourage everybody to at least go check out the launch. And if not, check out a little bit more, because there are some other things about like the science and some people from NASA speaking and the significance of it and stuff like that. And it's a win. It's a win for people, for humans. It's going to space. There's also a plan to go to the moon in 2024 again, which I didn't realize. So yeah, like there's an awful lot going on, which I think is really, really fun. So worth checking out. For me,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I would also like to get off the planet too sometimes, but you know.
Yep. Wouldn't That'd be we nice. All? Nice. Wouldn't yeah. we all? Well, speaking of escapism into fantasy, sci-fi, and oh, I don't know, how about superheroes? I have finally seen Spider-Man Far From Home.
It's about time.
Have you seen it? You've seen it.
I have seen
Okay.
it.
Okay. So, spoiler warning. Now, granted, it's been a year, but I've not talked about it on the podcast. But anybody that hasn't seen it, I can't talk about it without spoiling a bunch of stuff. So if you haven't seen it, maybe tune out and come back another time. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really fun, fun film and did a lot for Spider-Man as a character. Like how did, what were your first impressions of it?
I mean, I think I definitely like the Tom Holland version of Spider-Man a little bit more than I think I've liked any of the others. Mm-hmm. Mostly because Tom Holland is just such a genuine, cute little bean of a person who's so genuine in his delivery, and you can tell he's done a lot of work, and like, you know, he's really, really got down that, like, you know, Peter is a teenager.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people forget that, and I know that Tom Holland is, you know, in his 20s, but he looks like a teenager. He looks like a baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the issues that I had with previous iterations of anything is that, like, they were casting, you know, 28-year-olds as 18-year-olds, you know, and, like, you look very different from 18 as you do at 28. Like, it's very, very different looking. So the fact that, like, they're keeping Peter grounded in this, you know, teenager-like state, you know, without aging him up too much, but still having him do, you know, pretty intense things, like it feels like a kid who's got a lot of responsibility and is still trying to figure out how to use all of his responsibility. It doesn't feel like, you know, oh, I am now the Spider-Man, and I have great power comes great responsibility, Uncle Ben. I totally get that. I don't know, the other ones, they took themselves a little bit too seriously sometimes, and this one kind of had a nice balance of like, still kids, they're still idiots. Yeah, but also, you know, there's some big things that happens, but they're still idiots. Yeah, they're still kids.
They can still make some pretty dumb decisions.
So it's got this nice balance. Yeah.
I agree. Tom Holland, actually, his birthday was just 2 days ago. He's 24. Mm-hmm. I looked that up because I was curious. I knew he was in his early 20s, but
he's a baby.
I find him very genuine as well. And I think that was the first thing that I took away from this that stood out to me as a major positive. on top of just how fun the movie was, is that the level of acting from Tom Holland, even from Endgame to now, even from like the other films that he's been into now, it's leaps and bounds. Leaps and bounds. Yeah. There's a lot of moments where, because this is the first movie, this first step that I've taken beyond Avengers Endgame, where Tony Stark and Black Widow and Vision are all dead. There's a lot of weight and a lot of absence, you know, in this, and a lot of rebuilding for a lot of people. And they address that actually really interestingly with like a school news report at the very beginning, that the kids are on like a school news station and they're talking about what they call the blip, which is the 5 years that everybody was absent. And when the snap was brought back, all these high school kids were brought back and they're the same age. It's why Tom Holland, or Spider-Man rather, I keep on conflating the two, but that's why Peter Parker is still 16, even though he was missing for 5 years. Everybody's the same boat. So there's some really cool dynamics that they have where like the dorky kid that used to have a nosebleed every 5 minutes is now this really hot 17-year-old that all the girls are going gaga over, but all the girls are still the exact same age that they were in Peter's class than when they left.
Right.
So there's all these really interesting kind of twists that they bring in. But Peter Parker is going to deal with the death of Tony Stark. And you get reminded just how much of a role Tony Stark has in this version of Spider-Man, right? He basically enables him to be a hero. Like, he gives him the gear. He gives him the opportunities. He trusts him.
Yeah.
And the weight of Tony's death on this kid is really obvious.
It's a lot.
And there's a scene on a plane when he's talking with Happy where I just, like, just broke for the guy. And then you realize, like, this is just Tom acting, you know, like I mean, it is remarkable how you're bringing that level of emotional connection to a superhero film, and a superhero film that doesn't have the same kind of weight that Infinity War and Endgame has. Like, you're not welling up with, you know, Peggy and Steve getting together in Endgame because it's been 9 years coming, right? This is just a kid frustrated with the death of somebody from last summer, right? Like, it's a lot narrower of a time frame to wrap your head around. And they just did a really good job of kind of, like, it's almost like the lines were not spoken. It's like when they can't finish sentences, you know, like, it's when they get the point across, but they sort of trail off. And they really nail how and why Tony Stark entrusted Peter Parker with all the things that he did, because he leaves him his glasses, and you think at first, wow, okay, that's kind of cool, but they're connected to a planetary defense system, which is a lot for a 16-year-old to have. It's like, here's the keys to the car, by the way, it's a really fast, expensive, deadly car. You know? And so that was really cool.
It was a good moment.
Yeah, it was a fun moment. Just like they add that level of like, yeah, don't forget, this is Spider-Man. He's an Avenger. Like, you know, reminding everybody that it's not just a vacation. But I really enjoyed that. I really also enjoyed the dynamic between Happy, Peter, and Aunt May.
Yes, me too.
I like that Peter Parker in this has allies. He's got people that know that he's Spider-Man. You know, I think it really helps. There's even like a line from Nick Fury in later on where it's just like, yeah, don't take the mask off. Everybody knows who you are. You're just being a douche, you know, like, just, you know, come on in, by the way, take the mask off. Everybody knows who you are. And because Peter's into that, like, I have to protect my identity sort of like stage of the superhero thing. He's like, oh, right. Super spies. You guys know everything. Yeah. You know, like, it's kind of funny in that way. And actually that's one of the better moments in the film too, where it's in the trailer, and actually, boy, there's a lot in the trailer that got cut out of this film, which is too bad, because there's quite a lot of really good scenes in that trailer. But there's a point where, Nick Fury wants Peter to help save the world from these attacks. And Peter's like, what about Thor? What about Captain Marvel? Like, just, he's basically like, is anybody else? Why are you choosing me? Like, I'm a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And he's like, and that's what I want to be. Like, I want to help people in my neighborhood. You know, like, I'm the Mr. Rogers of superheroes. I'm also 16.
Yes.
Like, I think one of the things that's so nice about Peter is that they play him in a way is like, you know, you're talking, you mentioned it earlier, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And Peter's like, nope, I don't want that. Like,
yeah,
no, thank
I mean,
you.
Like, I mean, like he does, he has it, but he's also like, this is kind of cool. I can just swing on webs and that's pretty neat. Like, you know, he's just, he is still a kid. And like, you know, one of the things, like the Sam Raimi movies have their own, they have their own charm for sure. Yeah. I think it's like the first time we saw Spider-Man, but like they are, the stakes feel so high.
Yeah.
In that one. And like, despite, you know, it's just being localized, the stakes feel so high. So I feel like it takes itself just a little too seriously. Mm. Whereas, you know, this one, it's still important. There's still, you know, a global planetary defense system that, you know, could be going off in a bad way at some point. Or like that's still a thing. But, you know, Peter is like, you know, he's like, I want to help the little people.
Yeah.
As much as possible. Like, I don't want to be, you know, one of the big heroes.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think they, like I said, they do a good job of like making it a serious threat. Like, I mean, spoiler, Mysterio is the bad guy. I knew that going in because he's a bad guy in the comics, but it's kind of,
it's Jake Gyllenhaal, who's just an evil person anyway.
Well, no, but it's
Jake Gyllenhaal's lovely, but he's got a good villain look.
Yeah. And it's kind of obvious, you know, from the get go in the movie, which I was disappointed by, because sometimes Marvel will spin it differently. Like, you know, sometimes the villain will still end up being the villain, but maybe they actually do start off as a good person. Like, sometimes they'll give them some real reasons to turn villain. But in this, it's just like, nope, he's just a scathed, you know, spurned by Tony Stark. You know, it felt pretty weak for Mysterio. Like, I was a little bit disappointed.
Yes, I agree.
I was also disappointed that everything that he was showing was so face value, especially because he was using like Stark developed technology against SHIELD. And they should, or former SHIELD, and they should at least be able to spot, you know, that kind of stuff. And I get the idea that, you know, Peter's supposed to be a young kid and easily duped, but I really, the decision that Peter makes to give the glasses, was it Edna or Ethan? I can't remember the lady's name. The AI has got a female name that Tony Stark developed for this.
Edith?
Edith. I think it might be Edith.
Edith.
And so he hands over control of the defense network to this guy he just met, who's clearly, to them, as far as they know, has superpowers. But, like, he's been there a day. You know, like, he doesn't.
Yeah, it's literally been a hot minute. But again, that comes from him being a teenager.
Yeah.
He's like, I've been given so much responsibility and I just need an adult. And here's an adult who knows what to do. So here you go, adult, have the power because I'm 16 and don't know what to do with it. Like, I can kind of see that.
It felt like this cross between like, okay, I get what you're trying to do, but it did feel like, I feel like I've been led that Peter's supposed to be smarter than this no matter what, like, even though he is a teenager.
Yes.
But I just...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I think they just kind of mixed it up because that decision is poor from an emotional standpoint. And I can see the failings of a teenager from an emotional standpoint, but then later on in the film, you realize just how intellectually smart Peter is, and you're just like, wow, but how did this not factor into his, you know, decision-making tree when it came to that?
So, I mean, you know,
but it, I mean,
I would say sometimes,
you know,
even if people are very, very intelligent, they may not be really good with common sense.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Right.
I agree. So. But anyway, it's a small nitpick in other words, otherwise very successful movie, because you have to give Mysterio this network. Otherwise the rest of it doesn't work. To go to your point, which is that it's a big event, and it's basically a terrorism level attack where, in order for Mysterio to build himself up as the hero, he's going to have to actually kill several thousand people in an attack in London, and then he's going to come in and save the day. But it's not going to be, I can't remember what he called it, something along the lines of like an Avenger level event where the Avengers would be needed. And I'm going to raise myself up by coming in and stopping what could have been tens of thousands of people dying, but it's not going to have the attention it needs if at least some people don't die. So the guy's off his rocker, right?
Right.
And I didn't necessarily need the bar monologue from him explaining everything, but I just kind of chalked it up to, I do believe in a very successful way that the Spider-Man films are actually aimed at a younger audience than the rest of the Marvel stuff. I feel like they're aiming at the high school kids and the college summer kids and that kind of stuff, which is fine. And so I know that. So I don't get too critical when they kind of like ham fist the plot down your throat, being like, oh, now this is where the villain monologues, just like a Disney cartoon. Because there are other cartoony bits about the film that I really didn't like. And I will not forgive. And that's Ned, Peter's best friend and like guy in the chair. He's a cartoon character and he always has been, but it worked in Far From Home. And I don't know why, but it was like a cheese grater for me it worked in Homecoming, but it did not work in this one. It did not work in Far From Home for me. I just thought it was ridiculous. I get that they were trying to be funny. I thought it was dumb. I feel like even 16-year-olds will have a sense of what a relationship actually is. And the relationship between, I think her name's Kelly. She's the news lady from the news kid from the beginning of the film. Ned and her sit on the plane together and they fall in love and they have this like romance that's over by the time the movie's over, by the way. And they talk about it like divorcees of 20 years. Like it just, even if you're going to say like, yes, you know, teenagers, and I don't know any, nor do I have any, are these emotional, you know, fly by the seat of their pants, you know, people, I still think they all have enough common sense to treat that. I feel like they could have done that in a much different way and not have it be.
You know what it felt like? It kind of reminded me of Degrassi a little bit. Like I don't know if you've watched.
I haven't. It's been a Degrassi long at all, time.
But like it's been a long time.
The original, but, like, maybe when I was 12. We're talking a long time ago.
My sister was watching some of it, and I was just kind of like, you know, just on FaceTime with her while she was watching it, and it was like someone was just like, oh, we totally did. Like we dated for 3 months. That's so long. And I'm just like, I guess to teenagers, maybe it really is that long.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, that I get, you know, but we're talking about a 6-hour flight. Yeah. Right, like it just, and there just seems to be an awful lot of like, I feel like it's almost insulting to teenagers. Like, I think that's probably my problem that I have with it is that they talk about it in such a, our love was it, you know, it was a beautiful thing, but beautiful things don't last, Peter. And he's looking at Ed like, you are weird. But you as the audience member are looking at him in the same way, but not in a I love you, Ned way. It's kind of like, oh my God, can you just go away? Like you just,
Ned,
a lot of what he contributes to the conversation is not necessary, which he did. It was necessary in the first film because he was helping Peter like sleuth. You know, he was helping Peter try to find out things, looking stuff up online, and, you know, kind of helping him in that way. I did really like the role shift for Ned later on when MJ figures out that Peter is Spider-Man. And again, I think it's cool that Peter Parker has got a bunch of people that know rather than the endless charade of him hiding.
Yes.
Because Happy, Aunt May, Ned, and now MJ all know that he's Spider-Man. And I love that because it just allows him some moral support. It also provides some really fun scenes. I've always liked it in superhero films when you know that the superhero is the superhero and you have been there when they did the first superhero stuff, but you get to relive that every time someone new figures out that this person that they've been friends with for 10 years is actually the superhero. And there was some really cool moments. Like, I love that Peter is trying to express his love for, well, his feelings. I don't know if he's in love with her, but he really likes Mary Jane. And he's trying to tell her how much he likes her and that he bought her this flower, this necklace. And he's like, I have something to tell you. And he just about gets to it. And she goes, you're Spider-Man. and he just completely cuts them off. And he's like, no, that's not, she's looking at him.
She's like, you're Spider-Man. I know. Yeah. I figured it out.
And he's like, looking at her like, no, this is harder than it's supposed to be. This is hard enough already. You don't need to do this. And it was just this deer in a headlights thing. And then they discover, they realize that Mysterio is the bad guy, and he just flips around, turns head over heels and be like, yep, I'm Spider-Man and this is bad. And she's like, wait, what? I was right? I was like only 60% right. Like, or I was only 60% sure. Like, she wasn't really there. She was just kind of accusing him as just kind of like a way to avoid.
Like a play for jab. Yeah,
a way to avoid her own feelings. And so that, I thought that exchange was really, really well done. And then of course you get this whole part of just like, you know, I need my suit and I got to do this. But then Ned comes in and then it becomes like a little bit of a sparring match between Ned and MJ as the like, but I was here first. Like I knew mm-hmm. I was the guy in the chair before you were the girl in the chair, you know?
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed that part with Ned because that felt sincere. Like it felt like the kind of teenage banter and the kind of one-upmanship that you'd normally see in those kind of situations. So yeah, I enjoyed all of that kind of stuff. I got one more negative point before I get to my biggest thing that I thought was the best part of the film. Not the best part, but one of the things that really stuck out. But I enjoyed the awkward chemistry between Peter and MJ right up until the end. And then I feel like they ripped the rug out from underneath me. And I've seen an awful lot of deleted scenes and stuff that was in trailers that wasn't in the film. And I'm wondering if it was either intended to be that awkward in terms of their kiss at the end, or if it was just a victim of editing. Because their first kiss...
I feel like it was a victim of editing.
Their first kiss, they edited it out. You don't see it.
Oh, really?
You see the lean in, and you see the lean out. And there is no shot of them kissing. It was like, what just happened there? And it was a peck. Like, it was... I just kissed my brother. Like, it was really, really strange. And despite the fact that I know they're teenagers, I know it's supposed to be awkward. They've been awkward this whole time. She's even said that she's awkward about her feelings. But you can tell from different moments throughout the film that they both like each other. And I just think that, yes, while it might not be the most realistic thing for a teenager to be able to scoop a girl up in her arms and actually kiss her, I think they still should have shown up just a Hollywood moment of just like, you know what? You guys get this one, because you really didn't get the payoff. It really just felt super like awkward, but not in a gratifying or funny way. Those moments were already past. We had those. I really just kind of wanted Peter to get the girl, but in a way that was satisfying for everybody. And it just didn't really feel that way. You get a better moment of it later when they're coming off the plane holding hands. That's more touching than what should have been, I think, the better. Like, I just, not only do I really like you and you really like me back, but also I almost died and you saved all of us because you're Spider-Man and I know you're Spider-Man. Like, there's all that behind there. And then they peck. It was just odd to me.
See, I kind of liked it because it's kind of like, I think because they'd already established them as both like super, super awkward people, especially MJ in particular, like, I don't think she knows how to be like super, super emotional. I don't think she's really good at like physical intimacy. And it was like, and you know, first kisses are always terribly awkward.
Yes.
Well, they're always terribly awkward. They're always terrible. My first kiss with my boyfriend was not great, but you know, you work at it. But it's like, it's, you know, I kind of liked it. I kind of liked how it took away that pretense, that like super crazy heightened romantic pretense that's usually in moments like that, and made it just kind of like a little softer and more youthful. Because it kind of took me back to like being a teenager and like liking someone a whole lot.
Yeah.
And like, awkward, really awkward first kiss. And I kind of liked that. It was like a sense of nostalgia from that. But I know where you're coming from. Like, you know, with all that, you know, history and all that, you know, it kind of came to like, you know, a cumulative
blip
moment.
Yeah.
And it kind of just sort of was just like, oh, that's a little bit
really
disappointing.
Really fizzles,
I get where you're coming from, but I think that's kind of why when I saw it, I was just like, ha, of course they would do that.
I kind of feel like,
and it was just, you know,
and I think too, that if it's a decision like that, then they could have maybe done it a little bit better. Like, just don't cut away. Show them be awkward. Show them do like a nose sword fight, or like, wait, do I go left? You go right.
Yeah.
You can do the awkward thing.
Nose sword fight.
Yeah, like, but you could do the awkward thing without them, without the cutting. I think the cutting is what made me think like, well, wait a minute. Why was
what's missing?
What
here?
Was
yeah.
the first take why was the first take so bad that you had to chop it up like this? It just felt like a really odd directorial decision, which I thought was strange. But to get back to what I thought was, like, the good part about this is that it's very character driven. Yes, there's a plot. Yes, it's Mysterio with holograms, and it's got this interesting kind of thing to it. In terms of, like, it's a cool Spider-Man villain they're bringing into the film, and it's not the deepest plot, but it is a vehicle for the character of Peter Parker to get over his pent-up feelings for MJ, you know, finally get that off his chest, which then allows him to tune into his spider sense, which gets him past the visual adversary of the deception, like the VR deception that these holograms projected by attack drones are thwarting him with. And you've seen him be defeated and hit by a train, you know, by Mysterio handily, in very cool visual, like Alice in Wonderland kind of moments. Reminded me some of the levels from Batman Arkham when you're fighting the Scarecrow, because he drugs you and he gets inside your head, and then you as a video game player are just dealing with, like, you know, mountain-sized Scarecrow trying to bite you, and, you know, you're falling, and then you're flying, and so Peter Parker and Spider-Man doing the same sort of thing fighting Mysterio, and, you know, he goes to punch Mysterio and Mysterio disappears and Peter punches a wall because he tricked him into doing it, you know. And he eventually uses his spider sense to close his eyes and just sense where everything is. And it is some of the best Spider-Man kick-ass stuff. Like, there's almost this little hint of, like, spider teenager becoming a man. Like, he really hauls ass and uses spider strength and webs and spinning and agility. Like, he does all of the things that you want him to do in a very convincing way, in a way that he's angry and tuned into that and desperate to save his friends and save everybody else, and mad that he's had to be deceived. And he's made that dumb decision of giving, you know, Edith to Quentin. I can't remember the guy's name, Quentin something back. And so he's like, he's angry at himself for, and you can see it all kind of come out in the way that they portray Spider-Man. And it's such a neat gimmick in that they're in Europe the whole time. The tallest building in most of these scenes is like 4 to 5 stories. So all of the Spider-Man stuff has got to be so inventive and so character driven, because he can't just phone it in and swing from a high building and be like, ooh, that's really cool. Like, everything that he did had to have a purpose. And it was as much a summer camp movie as it was a Spider-Man film. And I really think they nailed the balance. It was an awful lot of fun.
I agree.
It was an awful lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
I think that was honestly like the best time I've had watching a Marvel movie in a while. Mm-hmm.
Well, they've been so heavy for the last few years, right?
They've been so heavy. Yeah. So it was just, I mean, there were still heavy moments, but it was so, I don't know. It was just nice to kind of like.
Yeah. I would
have it be a little lighter.
I would put it up there with the first Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor Ragnarok as like level of fun.
Yeah.
You know, Thor Ragnarok had some serious moments at the end, but Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and even Ant-Man, actually Ant-Man was pretty funny too. So like, but they've treated Peter Parker in the way that I think keeps him light, but serious. And I like the, like you mentioned, like the earnestness of Tom Holland. Like, I can't remember what someone asked him, but it was like, there, I think it might have been MJ asking about, what are you guys doing, what are you dorks doing, or like, is that really something? And all Tom Holland says is no. All Peter Parker says is no, but like, it's no with an underlying fear of like, please don't find out what we were actually talking about.
Yes, like, yeah, and there's a lot of like layers to it, which is really nice.
And it has to do with like the pause and like how he handles it. And anyway, I just really, really enjoyed the film, and I highly recommend it for people that are looking for a fun action-based thing that has a lot of character moments and just a lot of laughs, but not all of them are ham-fisted. Like, really, most of them are really well-timed jokes. The flirting between Happy and Aunt May and Peter catching on, like, just, it only lasts a second, but it's, you're still laughing about it a scene later, you know, stuff like that was really good. But that's it. That's what I've been consuming this week. what has been on your big or small screen over the last little while?
Oh man. Well, the last season of She-Ra and the Princesses of Power was released in May, like end of May.
Right.
I can't remember how long it's been. I think it was like May 18th, I think it came out. And literally I've not been able to think about anything else. I know I've talked about it on the show before, but like, I remember, you know, kind of, you know, just being kind of like neutral about it. I was like, oh, this is cute. Like, I didn't really have a lot of expectations for it. And then it was around the end of season three into season four, I was just like, oh, okay, we've gotten into some heavy territory. And this is the final season. The fifth season is the final, is the last one. And it kind of just takes, it just, it's, I went back and I rewatched the whole thing. As soon as I finished the last episode of the fifth one, I was like, okay. And I started again from the very beginning, and I had to like go through. And it's like, it's the detail and the intricacies of like how Noelle Stevenson, who's the showrunner, she managed to, you know, every single season just got, the stakes just got higher and higher and higher in a way that like was really subtle that I didn't really notice at first. And then I went back and watched it again. I was just like, oh, I can see like, you know, callback moments that were like really, really little that, you know, I don't know. I have a lot of feelings about it, and I'm trying to like quantify my thoughts about it. It is literally like, it is solidified itself as one of my favorite animated shows, I think, just because of, well, you could feel the amount of love that went into the production of it from everybody, not just, you know, the actors, but also the crew. And even after it was done, like a couple days in, all of the crew were just like, block me now, like hide me, because, you know, I'm going to be talking about nothing else, and I'm going to be talking behind the scenes and spoilery stuff. And, you know, but like, you know, you could feel the amount of love that went into this production, and the voice acting was amazing. Like, even from, you know, episode one, which I actually, again, just went back and watched just in preparation for the show, and then watching the last episode of the last season, the depth that the actors have developed in their characters as they've grown with their characters and as their characters have grown is incredible. And yeah, so now that's out of the way. There's the thing that really got me the most about this one is that it really closed off the story nicely. There could be more later. Like, kind of left it open-ended enough that, like, hey, there could be future adventures later down the line, but it still felt like this chapter had closed in a very nice way.
Cool. I like it when shows do that. I like it when they do that.
Right, yeah.
I'd rather than come back 5 years later with another three-season run of maybe a different, like a character with a different look or a slightly older,
yeah,
rather than run for, yeah, 7 or 8 years. Like, I'd rather have a break,
yes,
you know?
Yeah. A lot of people are like, can there be a movie? Because I feel like, you know, so basically what happened, one of the major twists of this story that I thought was really interesting, especially for, you know, She-Ra, what Noelle Stevenson wanted to do is that she wanted to make sure that this was separate entirely from the He-Man universe. It kind of exists,
right,
in its own sort of pocket dimension. And, you know, there could be a possibility of a crossover at some point. That was something they were talking about, but it didn't quite fit with where they were going at that time. And, you know, she was saying, she's like, this isn't like the only version of She-Ra. It's like comic books. So you have like four different versions of Superman.
Right.
There's always going to be different versions of characters. And she's like, this just so happens to be our version of She-Ra, which, and I happen to really like. And one of the major twists with this one was that the planet that they're on, called Eternia, is actually a super weapon that no one knew about for a long, long time.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, it was like when I kind of forgot about it and then went back and watched it again, I was like, right, that's what happened. And that was the big twist. And so the whole premise of this one was that She-Ra and Adora, the, you know, who, the woman who is She-Ra, the girl, I guess, she's like a teenager. She she, you know, kind of, she finds the sword in the woods, she unlocks it, she's She-Ra, and it's kind of revealed that she is she is one of, you know, a group of people called the inhabitants of this planet called the First Ones. They were like the first settlers of this planet, and they've left a bunch of ruins and old technology everywhere. So there's a lot of like old, like super futuristic tech that also is kind of like a little janky looking. So no one, like, that's all done with like weird hieroglyphics and like weird, you know, writing structures that no one else can read. Like, no one's been able to really figure anything about these people, but Adora is one of them. And that's not really explained a lot. So I feel like something future could kind of explain, where did she come from? We know that she was brought in through like a portal by accident. And that's it. That's, you know, she doesn't really know anything else about her family. So there could be a potential of like a crossover going into like another dimension, so she can maybe find her brother and things like that. But it's the whole, it was revealed that the First Ones are actually pretty terrible people. Their whole mission was to go to different planets and basically sap up the magical resources from this planet and use it for themselves to kind of keep their civilization going. So it was, they're basically like eco-terrorists of some kind. And the last She-Ra before Adora was a woman named Mara, and she figured out that this is what was happening. And like the mantle of She-Ra was kind of like an honor, and like one person was chosen to do it, and it was like a long line. There's been like a long line of She-Ras forever. And the whole point was that there was never supposed to be another after Mara. Mara kind of sacrificed herself and like tried to, you know, hide all this stuff because she knew that this was a bad thing that was happening. But then when Adora came in and kind of took up the mantle, Adora is trying to figure out what's happening, and realizes, oh, I'm like, She-Ra is the catalyst for this weapon. She-Ra's whole point is to like set off the super weapon. That is the planet. And so one of the major climaxes of the whole show is Adora basically breaking She-Ra's sword and cutting off She-Ra entirely as a character.
Oh, wow.
Like, she kind of like destroys her. It gets really intense. But in the midst of that, there's still a war happening. You still have the Horde. You still have, you know, the Princess Alliance that's trying to stop the Horde, who's still trying to take over the planet. And then at the end of season 4, they bring in Horde Prime. So Hordak is kind of like, you know, his own little thing. He's kind of starting the war on his own time, and then he's doing it in the name of Horde Prime, who is like, you know, the big bad of season 5. So at the end of season 4, after Adora breaks She-Ra's sword, Horde Prime is coming in, because their planet was basically hidden in a pocket dimension, and when She-Ra broke the sword, it freed the planet from their pocket dimension. So now they're kind of at the mercy of the rest of the universe, including Horde Prime. And the whole season 5 is like Adora trying to wrestle with the fact that she doesn't have She-Ra anymore. She's still trying to, they're still fighting a war, and their major player is now not available, but she's still trying to act like she can do everything. So the character development across season 5 is incredible.
Visually, on the surface, it doesn't appear to be that deep. You know what I mean?
Like, that's what I like about it.
Which is good. But I think that it's good to know for people that would be interested in this kind of stuff. But then visually, you're just kind of like, I don't know if I really want to watch it. Just because it does kind of that Stevens universe. And well, no, and I know that She-Ra's always been pink. Like, it was always been that kind of a cartoon. Yeah. But I remember watching the one in the 80s and thinking I like it just as much as the He-Man cartoons. I mean, my sister used to watch it. And there was a direct tie in to He-Man at that point. Granted, She-Ra was a full-grown woman in the 80s in the cartoon.
Yeah.
But still kick butt. Like, she was not a Barbie princess, you know, like it was, even Aurora was feminine, but firm. Like, it wasn't like she was a pushover.
Yeah.
From what I recall, it's been a long time. But hearing about like the breaking of the sword and like, those are dealing with, more, I don't want to say adult, but they're dealing with deeper moral dilemmas than I would anticipate from a She-Ra cartoon. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's what I liked about it so much, because at a surface level, I'm just like, oh, I've heard good things about this. And I know a lot of people were praising it because it was, you know, Noelle Stevenson is a well-known name in comic books. Like, she's done Nimona and she's done Lumberjanes. And, you know, so she has a bit of a following anyway. And I think, you know, this is kind of coming out at a time that there wasn't a lot of content that was made mostly by women. Like, the crew and almost entirely for She-Ra is a lot of women writers, a lot of women producers. It's mostly run by women, and that doesn't happen a lot in animation. So a lot of people were just like, this is run by Noelle Stevenson, who's also an out lesbian, who's, you know, trying to make strives to make this a more of an inclusive show by showing various different body types and characterizations and you know, personalities, and, like, you know, not the stereotypical, like, you know, hourglass pretty princess. Like, there's one of the princesses is Scorpia. Now, I know they've, like, from the original lore of She-Ra, I know that, you know, characters like Scorpia and Trapta, Catra, they are exclusively antagonistic.
Right.
I don't know if they were ever princesses per se, but it was revealed that Scorpia is actually a princess, but she looks nothing like them. You know, she's half scorpion. She's really tall. She's really muscular. Like, she's known for being kind of like, you know, the brawn of, you know, most operations that she does. And she's really awkward and she's really clumsy, but she also has, you know, she's just such a genuine, like, warm-hearted character that she just wants to, like, she's a hugger. That's one of the things, like, when you first meet her, she's like, I'm a hugger, like, don't mind me. She's like, you know, for being an evil character, like, that's one of the things that's really brilliant about the show, is that the villains are depicted in a very, very human way. Like, even Hordak, like, you know, Hordak is the big bad at the, you know, in the beginning. He still has moments of humanity that kind of creeps in. And it's really, really great. And the character development that's happened across all the seasons has been spectacular. And in particular, one of the things that really drew me to it, especially this season, was the character development with Catra. In the beginning with, you know, Adora being part of the Horde, because I know that was part of the original She-Ra lore, is that Princess Adora was basically, like, stolen by the Horde and brainwashed. That is still a thing, except the difference with this one is that Adora was basically raised from infancy in the Horde. She was found after coming through a portal by Shadow Weaver, who basically adopted her and raised her to be a soldier for the Horde. So, literally, Adora knows nothing else other than the Horde, and she's kind of brainwashed into thinking that this is everything that I want. And she was raised alongside with her best friend Catra. So they have this deep history that is explored in various points of the show. And one of the things I like about the show too is that when it deals with, like, flashbacks, it does it in a way that, like, pushes the story forward more. It's not just like, oh, we're just going to give you some context. It does give you context, but it also is a catalyst to drive the story further as well, which is unique and not something I've ever really seen done before. So they have, like, you know, this deep relationship. They're clearly, you know, the closest out of everyone who's in the Horde. They are kind of like thick as thieves. And then when, you know, they decide to steal a skiff and they decide to, you know, leave the fright zone, and they kind of come upon the Whispering Woods and, you know, they kind of get in a little scuffle of, like, who's driving, and Adora ends up getting, you know, hit in the face with a tree branch and falls off and finds the sword and kind of starts having all these visions. And then, you know, Catra finds her and she kind of wakes up and she's realizing, oh, the sword's gone, but she can't get these images out of her head. So then she leaves kind of on her own accord and leaves Catra behind. And one of the things we learned about Catra is that Catra has really some really deeply rooted abandonment issues that is kind of explored more throughout the story. And we find out that, you know, Catra was always favored, like the golden child of, you know, of the Horde. She was favored by Shadow Weaver. And, you know, even if, you know, Adora was an instigator when they were kids for any, like, you know, wrongdoings, Catra would always get the blame for it. Even though Adora tried to, like, you know, take the blame, but, like, it was never, Shadow Weaver was always very favored. She favored Adora a lot. So there's this, like, slight rift in their relationship as friends where Catra definitely feels second best. And then, you know, the one person that she always went to for, you know, support and comfort is Adora. And Adora leaves the Horde to become She-Ra. Catra has this really deeply rooted abandonment problems that kind of manifests itself in very antagonistic behavior. So her whole motive for the entire show is just, my best friend left me, I don't know what to do about it, so I'm just gonna lash out. in every single way possible because she doesn't know how to deal with her emotions in any way. And I think it's important for kids to be able to see that it's okay to, you know, not okay, but that stuff can happen. And there's better ways to deal with your emotions about it. But it sounds like
the things, and this is what I mean by nice to see more from an animated show. Because the things that you're describing remind me of two very popular, I want to say adult aimed entertainment. And that is, Gamora and Nebula from Marvel, right? With Katra and She-Ra or Adora. And that abandonment thing and the pushing and the, and like the who's better and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
But then also the way that the planet is set up in terms of being harvested and the fact that despite all of that, there's still these conflicts and differences and decisions that have to be made for the greater good reminds me of the World of Warcraft, which is Azeroth, which is not necessarily a super weapon, but it's regarded as a planetary spirit that could, if awoken by the right or wrong side, be the most powerful Titan to ever live. So the Legion is trying to corrupt and destroy Azeroth. I think the Void Lords are trying to possess Azeroth, and the Titans are trying to save Azeroth. All of which is happening around the Horde and the Alliance, which are basically skirmishing over land on Azeroth. But some of the Alliance heroes and some of the Horde heroes, of course, are in tune with what is going on in the planet and have to make greater decisions than just the war that's at hand, but they still have to deal with the war at hand because you have bad actors like Sylvanas and other characters in World of Warcraft, like I'm blanking on his name. It was a war chief orc guy for a long time.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't remember
his name. I don't remember his name. Not Doomhammer. That's the good war chief. Anyway, not important. Point being that these are all gray moral compass decisions, you know, that characters have to make, you know, in order to either thwart their upbringing. Hellscream is the guy that I was thinking of. They have to make these decisions that go against the very fiber of being Horde, is like align with the Alliance, you know, but when it means that you get to save the world, then, well, I guess you kind of have to, you know. As you're being describing the stuff from the animated show from She-Ra, it's just reminding me that I don't want to say it's copying at all. That's not at all what I'm saying. It's taking the themes that I really enjoy from these very big, very mature from a narrative perspective IPs and kind of like folding it and making it their own and making it, you know, palpable for kids to watch. It's also done by DreamWorks and probably looks really pretty when it's all said and done, because
it does. Yeah, it, like, honestly, it is like the amount of, again, it, like, you can see and feel the amount of love and blood, sweat, and tears that went into the production of it, because everything is just so spot on and pristine. And, like, you know, the writing team did a really, really great job, and, like, you know, backgrounds, like, everything just looks so, so beautiful. But I think this show is really important. Like, I would have loved the show as a kid, like, you know, as like a young teenager, because it's, you know, season five especially kind of deals with, like, you know, on top of dealing with a war, it's a bunch of kids also trying to sort out their feelings for each other. And, like, one of the things that, you know, I don't know if this is ever on your radar at all, but one of the things that the show is building towards from the beginning was an eventual relationship between Katra and Adora. And it's, like, you know, struggling with, you know, being best friends and also, like, as, you know, as, like, a person who's part of the LGBTQ community, you know, kind of wrestling with the fact that, like, I did have some crushes on some of my friends, and how did that navigate into, like, how I reacted around them. And, you know, that was, there's a lot of, I see a lot of myself in both Katra and Adora for certain things. And I'm sure there's a lot of other, like, you know, teenagers who are watching the show now who feel very validated and feel very seen by, you know, the content that's being put out with She-Ra. But it's what I like about it is that it's not done in a way that feels voyeuristic or forced. And there was even a moment where I was just like, I don't know if they're ever going to come back. Because there's a moment at the end of season three where Catra basically, like, tries to set off the weapon because she thinks it's the only... She's just so angry and so, like, vicious about everything that's been happening and going on. And, like, the fact that, you know, her Adora left her. She has feelings for Adora, but she doesn't know how to quite quantify that. And so she's like, I'm just going to destroy everything because I don't know what else to do. There's, like, a moment where, like, it's like, I don't think they're ever going to be able to come back from this. So, but the way that this season deals with it in terms of character development, I would say that Catra's redemption arc in this series, in this season, is close to, if not on par with, Zuko from Avatar The Last Airbender and his redemption arc. Hers happens a little bit faster because they have more of a time constraint because they've been spending all this time building her up to be an antagonist and, like, the primary antagonist, but you can see, like, the chinks in the armor throughout the season. Like, there's, you know, a moment in season three or four where, you know, Catra is kind of putting on a brave face and, like, everything's going exactly the way she wants it to, but she's still having complete emotional meltdowns all over the place because she's, like, she doesn't know what she wants. So then when there's an episode in season five called Corridors where, you know, at the end of season four, Adora's friend Glimmer, who's the queen of Brightmoon, is basically kidnapped by Horde Prime, and Catra ends up in there as well. So Catra's trying to use her manipulation tactics to kind of, you know, get on Horde Prime's good side, but he's seeing through everything that she's pulling at him. She has a lot of freedom on the ship, while Glimmer's kind of more in a cell, like some kind of cell. And Catra is trying to, like, you know, also talk to her while also, like, you know, because she's lonely, but, is, you know, I know that this is my enemy, so I'm not really sure how to deal with you. While she's also kind of, like, thinking back on, you know, her past and her friendship with Adora. And kind of there's this moment where she's like, you know, someone asks her, do one good thing in your life. Glimmer, like, tells her, like, do one good thing in your life because Adora is trying to come save Glimmer. And because no one knows that Adora is not She-Ra anymore. Like, there's a couple people who know, but, like, the main antagonists don't really know that she's not She-Ra anymore. They just kind of know, oh, she's the catalyst to unleash this weapon, which is what Horde Prime wants. And so if Adora were to show up at Horde Prime's ship, he would kill Adora. And that's, you know, kind of the thing that everyone's trying to prevent. So Catra kind of has to make a decision of, like, what do I want to do? Do I want to be... You know, do I want to save Adora? Do I want, you know, the world to end? And it's like, it's, you can see the minute where it's like, she just decides, no, I got to do a good thing. And it's really powerful. And it's really, it was a really good moment. And I haven't seen a moment like that in a show in a very, very long time where it's like an instant, like not an instant flip, but like where you can see the definitive, like, I'm making a choice right now and I cannot go back from it. And it's very, very good.
One question that I have with all of the different representation from the LGBTQ community in the show, do you know, or was it well presented in terms of what the show is rated? I did a quick search while you were talking, and it says that Netflix officially rates the show as TV Y7FV,
yes,
which means that it does not, that yes, it does contain some fantasy violence, but children's ages 7 and up,
yeah,
in most cases, yeah, would be okay watching. I mean, obviously, when they say in most cases, they're leaving, like, obviously there's some parental discretion, and stuff in there. I'm just wondering, like, I mean, do you think, would you agree with that?
I 100%, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the way it treats everything like it's not a big deal. And I think the thing with kids is that, you know, if you treat something like a big deal, they're going to treat it like a big deal.
Right.
If it's just, this is how it is, they're like, okay.
This is normal, then,
like,
yeah.
Right, and I just, you know, I remember, you know, a conversation with my sister when she was really young. You know, one of my last partners was transgender, and when my sister first met them, they went by she, and then, you know, as our relationship progressed, they started to go by he, and she asked me, she was like, why does this person dress like a boy? Like, why is that? And I was like, they just feel more like a boy. And she's like, okay.
Right.
And that was it. That was the conversation.
All the explanation that was needed, yeah.
Right? Right? And that was it. And she was 7 at the time. So, like, you know, as long as everything is treated like this is just kind of how it is. And I think, you know, I do think some of it was a little bit of fan service for, you know, older fans who kind of were able to pick up on more of the nuanced,
sure,
things. It is a pretty, you know, it can be pretty heavy. Like, a lot of it is meant to be, I think, more for, you know, teenagers. But, you know, they're right away, there's two kind of side princesses, Spinnerella and Natasa, who are, they're part of the Princess Alliance, but they're not really, you know, a big part of it until later seasons. But they are canonically married, and you see them, you know, call each other sweetheart and honey, and they give each other quick kisses, and, that's it. It's just kind of treated like a very, very normal thing.
Similar to what we've seen in the Dragon Prince as well.
Exactly. Yeah. You see, there's a non-binary character, Double Trouble, and I know that Double Trouble in the original was like a shapeshifter, it was a woman, but this character was, you know, because they can change into anything, they're basically like a pretty androgynous, nondescript, kind of lizardy sort of character.
Okay.
But their pronouns, even Big Bad Hordak was saying they, you know, using proper pronouns
right.
for them. So it was, all of it was treated as like a very just, this is how it is.
I like, but also very aware of the world that
yes.
it's being
yeah.
launched into and presenting and just taking the time. It just like, it just feels like you said, the love and the energy that went into it and the patience to take the time to think about
yes.
all the little things that then add up
yes.
to the normalcy that you're picking up on when you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So it doesn't feel like it's like shoved in your face. Like there are some shows, I think we talked about it before. It's not just like, you know, we're going to drill this message into your face, like a whole bunch. It's kind of just a result of the world. It's just a thing that's just a thing in that world. And that's, you know, and no one questions it. No one says anything negative about it. So, you know, but I think what I like most about it is that like the character development and especially in this last season, particularly with Catra and Adora, there was a moment where I was just like, I don't think this is going to happen. I don't think this is going to happen. Like, you know, I think it was the thing that most people wanted to happen, because there were definitely hints of like romantic tension and things, that could have been played off as like playful banter, but you know, there was definitely like this underlying tension that just seemed a little bit more than, you know, just, you know, friends being mad at each other. It was like the betrayal just felt so deep that there was something a little bit more to it that, you know, it just, there was a little bit of an extra step up. So there was a minute where I was like, they're not gonna be able to come back from this. There was some bad shit that happened, and Catra did some really, really terrible things, and Adora was very much like, this is 100% not okay. And like, you can see the minute where, like, you know, throughout this whole time, even though they've been fighting, Adora has never, like, you know, been incredibly, like, she's been cranky with Catra, but she's never been like furious. And there's one shot where they animated her eyes is like if looks could kill in an animated show, like the look that Adora gave Catra at this one minute was just like, oh, that's it. There's no going back. So the
that's
way they managed
to do
it's hard to do.
Yeah.
It's hard to do. And it was very, that's the minute where I was just like, oh no, we've hit a minute where this is an intense show now. This not just like a nice, light, fluffy story about princesses. This is gotten to a very serious moment. And it was a lot. So like, so this season was kind of like exploring them kind of coming back for each other, but it's also kind of showing Adora's, you know, unwavering loyalty, you know, Catra essentially like knows, okay, if Adora comes here, she's gonna die. Genuinely under the assumption, she's like, well, I don't matter, I have nothing else for me, Adora hates me, I don't want anyone else, there's no other friends, because she's basically like burned all of her bridges
right.
Throughout the course of the season. Like, any friends that she made, she basically would just got so vicious and nasty because she didn't know how to deal with anything, that she just kind of pushed everyone away. So she has nothing else for her back on their planet at all. So she knows that Adora is coming specifically for Glimmer. So she's like, I'm gonna free you. I'm gonna let you go. She basically, you know, attacks all of the clones that are on the ship that they're on, and manages to get a hold of Adora. And at the last minute, there's a little flashback scene where she's a kid, where she says, I'm never gonna say sorry to anybody ever. Like, you know, as a kid, like, you know, I'm like, and she never has. And then there's like this ending moment at the episode where she apologizes to Adora for everything that she's done before she's like, you know, subdued by all the clones and basically put in prison, more or less, and brainwashed into being, you know, part of Horde Prime's like weird cult. That's like another factor of this is like everyone's being like chipped with microchips and basically turned into like drones. Drones for him. It gets you know, that's a normal sci-fi thing, right? But it's got something for everybody. And the music is amazing. If you're into music like I am, there's one song. I'm sorry, I keep this is so, it just does a lot for me apparently. There's one song in an episode in the first season called Promise, and there's a She-Ra soundtrack as well. When this song first comes up, it's basically, you know, Adora and Catra have kind of come together and seeing each other in person for the first time since they both parted ways. And they're kind of like forced to go through moments of their history together. And like, you know, again, the flashback sequences are kind of being, you know, they're in a spaceship that pulls from their memories and kind of forces them to relive them again. And kind of this is another moment where Catra kind of makes a decision to be like, no, I want to separate myself from this situation. She doesn't know how to handle her emotions, so she just decides to be, I'm going to be vicious and push everyone away. So she basically turns on Adora in a really gut-wrenching kind of way, and this song called Promise is like playing in the background, and it's like big swelling music, and it doesn't happen again until the minute where Catra is saving Glimmer and she's apologizing to Adora, and then it happens at the end where she basically is like, listen, I've always loved you, and you know, is trying to help her save the planet in like a last kind of last ditch effort to, you know, to save everything, where Adora is not doing so hot at the time. So it's the music is, there's so much detail in it, and the music is beautiful and there's great intricate detail, and it just feels nice to have a show that kind of just represents things in a way that's just really genuine and not, you know, not in a way that's like voyeuristic or uncomfortable. Yeah. It just kind of lays it out. Here it is, and here's the story, and it's going to be a happy ending. I don't know. It's really
nice.
You
and I have talked before on the show about cartoons that talk down to the audience, that don't that don't give them enough credit to kind of fill in the blanks.
This does not
trying
do
to
that.
Have to explain does everything. Not. That's good. That's good. So yeah, all 5 seasons on Netflix. That's good that you don't have to wait if you want to watch and just binge the whole thing, because people have time. So yeah,
it's so good.
And that's the thing, and that's the kind of thing though that informs Netflix. Like when people dive into these shows and they have major watch numbers, that gives Netflix the green light on their end to be like, hey, this drove viewers. Let's make more of these kinds of things, you know. And so I think that's important too. It's on my list. I haven't gotten around to it yet. It's been on my list since you told me about it months and months ago, but I just, like I said,
it's an easy watch. Yeah. Like it is definitely an easy watch, and the first seasons 2 and 3 I think are a little shorter.
Nice.
So it's really 4 seasons. One season was kind of split into 2 different groups of shorter, less episodes.
Right. Yeah.
So it's only like 50
probably
episodes,
an effort to get it out more often rather than having big gaps, like maintain the momentum and try to get things out there as much as possible.
Exactly.
Well, that wraps up this episode of the Citadel Cafe. You can find links to all the things that Megan and I talked about today on thecitadelcafe.com. Music for the show was composed by Kevin McLeod. You can email us at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or just find the show by name on Twitter. Subscribe for free on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. But you know what? Word of mouth is the easiest way to support the show. Just tell a friend about it. Say, hey, you should listen to the Citadel Cafe. I liked it. You will probably like it too. You'll be really surprised how far that actually goes. Leave a star review. This is something new I want to mention. The Apple Podcasts app, even if you don't use that app to listen to the show, if you pop on there and leave a review for the Citadel Cafe, it goes a long way for the show to reach new listeners, because many of the apps out there will ping the iTunes store or the Apple Podcasts app now to figure out what you might be looking for when you search for, oh, I don't know, She-Ra. you might find this episode. And so by leaving a review, it really is a 100% free way that you can boost our visibility to the eyeballs and the ear holes out there that are looking for podcasts. So check that out. Leave us a star review and leave us a review on whatever podcast platform you want. But really, the Apple Podcasts app is where I kind of want to drive people right now. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online, including my illustration and design portfolio and online shop at joelduggan.com. If you'd like to hire me, then just drop me a line through the site. You can check out my other podcast, all about Minecraft, at thespunchunks.com. We actually spent this week talking about Minecraft Dungeons, which was released last week. It is a heck of a lot of fun. So if you want to hear Johnny and I talk about punching zombies in the face, then check that out at thespawnchunks.com. You can also follow me at Joel Duggan on social media, just about everywhere. And twitch.tv/Joel Duggan is where you can actually watch me punch said zombies in said faces and have a lot of fun doing so. I've been streaming Minecraft Dungeons a lot in the last week. Megan, where can people find you and all the stuff that you're doing online?
People can find me online on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube at @OMeganTownsend. Oh, and also Twitch. I always forget that. Twitch.tv/OMeganTownsend as well.
You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.